We need listener feedback on what we're doing with the Week in Review podcast. Please send us any comments or suggestions, complaints, or questions to podcast@arctimes.com. That's podcast, plural with an S. podcasts at arctimes.com. This is the Arkansas Times Week in Review podcast for Friday, April 12th, 2024. Thanks for joining us. My name is Omaya Jones, and today we're talking about the University of Arkansas's hiring of Coach John Calipari away from Kentucky and the status of Bitcoin mining in the state after last year's passage of Act 851, which prohibited local governments from regulating the practice. But first, on Wednesday, the 2024 fiscal session of the Arkansas legislature kicked off, with Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders giving the State of the State address, which included outlining a $6.3 billion general revenue budget. Managing editor Benjamin Hardy and reporter Dave Ramsey broke down the numbers.
So it is, as we record this, it is Thursday, and the legislative session kicked off yesterday, Wednesday. That's the fiscal session this year. You know, fiscal sessions happen on even-numbered years, and that means that unlike on during the regular session last year, we don't have to worry about the state pass or the legislature passing a bunch of new laws, that will have. You know, far-reaching consequences, but they're talking about the budget and setting the agenda for the budget, and that is, you know, has significant effects downstream all across the state. I'm joined here by Dave Ramsey, who's been watching this and is going to be with us throughout the fiscal session. So let's just start off by talking about what is in the budget. What does Governor Sarah Sanders propose? How is it different from previous years?
She has proposed a $6.3 billion general revenue budget. As you were kind of alluding to, I think these kinds of appropriation bills can be kind of dry, but the funding levels sort of impact the scope of what the state government actually can do, sometimes just as much as the kind of policy-related stuff that, you know, has more fireworks and that kind of thing.
Right.
But there's kind of two big points to stress on this budget. The first is that, so it increases versus last fiscal year by $109 million, which is a 1.76% increase. But that is a much lower rate of growth than we normally see. Usually it's been an increase of around 3%. I believe that was the increase from 23 to 24. And now going from 24 to 25, it's much less than that.
Yeah.
The other point to say quickly on that is that the biggest, when we look at that $109 million increase, 60% of that is an increase in funding for LEARNS vouchers. So these are the vouchers that enable, you know, families to send their kids to private school. So the growth in that funding is making up a really big chunk of the growth such as it is. So even that 1.76% number, it kind of overstates it in a way. If you take out that LEARNS bump, then you wind up, according to my back of the napkin calculations, it's something like 0.7%.
Yeah.
So it really shows that the governor is going in a very kind of right-wing austerity direction that I think is maybe a little bit surprising. I mean, if you think about her father, Mike Huckabee, you know, for all of his faults, he wasn't really a doctrinaire right winger on spending.
Sure. I mean, he expanded our kids or created our kids.
Exactly. I think he had a kind of socially conservative approach, but was not a kind of hardcore austerity guy by any means when it came to spending for people in need. And I think the governor is revealing that she is kind of taking a more of a hardcore right winger approach just in terms of what she's willing to spend. And I guess the other point I would raise is that, you know, if you think about the amount that the vouchers are taking up, I think given that sense of austerity that we see from the governor's approach, it's hard not to conclude that, I mean, number one, she's kind of prioritizing private school families over other issues and other people that may need funding in the state. And I think it also has to mean that, you know, paying for those vouchers is crowding out other spending that might otherwise go to childcare, healthcare, other, you know, pre-K, other various other needs in the state, I think are probably losing out at the margin to the vouchers.
You know, I think it's important to remember too, like, I mean, the state's population is constantly growing, you know, so that means, like, you know, the cost of providing services, be it public schools or whatever, is constantly growing as well, you know. And so, I mean, it's not like this year-over-year growth is just like something that the state is wanting to do, you know, sort of arbitrarily.
That's right. And in particular, I mean, especially now when inflation is not as high as it was, but it is still higher than it has been. And I think that in times of high inflation, when you talk about, right, you know, this is where conservatives will always get mad when you say that a budget like this is slashing spending, because it is in raw terms increasing spending year over year. But if it's not keeping up with inflation, you know, if inflation is at whatever, 5.5%, and you have a 1.76% increase in government spending, that's in practice a cut. And so I think that's another piece of context here, is that, you know, again, it's typically been closer to 3% increases in the past. And so if we're kind of going backwards from that baseline at a time of higher inflation, that's really, again, an approach that I think you would characterize as, you know, kind of right-wing style austerity. And I think that there will be some real cost to that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, one other thing on that point is, like, I mean, you mentioned Mike Huckabee. It's also Donald Trump, who, like,
For sure.
One would think that Sarah Sanders, I mean, you think of her as a very Trumpian Republican, and, you know, Trump certainly embraced tax cuts, but also sort of notably rejected the idea of, like, significant entitlement reform and so forth. I mean, he's not a fiscally conservative guy.
Yeah, I had the exact same thought. It is a kind of departure from, I think, what is probably the most politically potent version of Trumpism, and if I was to put on my pundit's hat, would be some combination of kind of, you know, being sort of fiscally generous combined with weird insult comic culture war stuff that gets his base riled up or whatever. Uh-huh. But you don't have to combine that with austerity. And as you say, Trump is complicated because his rhetoric doesn't always match his actions. And certainly there were attempts that he supported to, you know, I mean, the budget that I guess it was Paul Ryan, when he first arrived,
right,
was pushing and involved attempts to implement Medicaid cuts. And that ended up not going anywhere. The tax cuts were successful, but the spending cuts weren't. So we just saw the budget increase. That's right, kind of the Trump strategy. But again, I think in terms of his rhetoric, certainly, you know, Trump's attitude is to say you can have it all, you know, budget be damned. And I think this budget looks more like what we would associate with, you know, a kind of Paul Ryan style approach, you know, or even a traditional Republican approach. I mean, kind of, I think when Tom Cotton was coming up, or if you think about other prominent Republicans in the state, they have tended to have this kind of slash spending attitude.
Which is, I mean, you think about like Asa Hutchinson, you know, a very establishment, fiscally conservative Republican, though, you know, his budgets were, he was not controlling growth the way that
he was less aggressive. Now, it should be said that this has been a long-standing complaint of, you know, of liberal advocates, certainly of the Hutchinson administration, and really dating back to, you know, the Beebe administration as well, that there has been a general tendency in budgeting process to arguably kind of artificially create surpluses by kind of underfunding everything. Then you get the kind of the nice headline about a surplus, you know, and obviously that can come in handy in a pinch. I suspect there's some element of just, you know, the executive branch having a little more leeway and control when you have that kind of surplus over what ends up happening. But there's been a longstanding complaint that kind of the budgeting process and the forecasts that are behind the budgeting process have sort of systematically underfunded everything in the whole budget, in the sense that they are kind of, they're designed to be essentially too conservative by design. And that's been a longstanding complaint. I think what stands out about this new budget is, you know, it has that same kind of structural issue, but then with a little more ideological pepper, so to speak.
We'll hear more from Benji and Dave later about the status of Bitcoin mining centers in the state. But first, On April 10th, the University of Arkansas made it official and announced John Calipari as the new coach of the Arkansas Razorbacks basketball program, replacing Eric Musselman, who went to USC after coaching the Razorbacks for the past five seasons. Under Musselman, the Hogs went 47-42 and reached the Sweet 16 in the 2023 NCAA tournament. Calipari comes to Arkansas after coaching Kentucky for the past 15 years, where they won a championship in 2012. Reporter Rhett Brinkley sat down to tell me everything we know about how the situation developed. Okay, so we're talking about the Calipari hire, but it might be important to set the stage here. As I said when we talked about the hiring of Bobby Petrino, I don't really follow college sports. So my first question is, should I have been surprised by the announcement that Musselman was moving on?
Yes and no. If you were paying like attention to the season, you probably wouldn't be surprised because Musselman's body language throughout the year, I mean, he didn't seem very happy. But it was also his first losing season as a head coach in college basketball. It was also the Razorbacks' first overall losing season since John Pelfrey was head coach in 2009, 2010. And there was just a lot of just drama on the team this year. Debo Davis stepped away for a few games, and Musselman's teams in the SEC start slow sometimes, but he's always been able to like kind of turn it around, and that didn't happen this year. So, you know, the fan base is very excited by him. So as somebody that like doesn't watch college basketball, yeah, I guess it could be a surprise. I guess to those paying attention, it wasn't that shocking that maybe he was looking for something else.
Okay.
Plus, there had been reports that he would always at some point, I mean, reporters that follow him assumed that at some point he'd go out west because he has ties to the West Coast. He went to college at the University of San Diego, played basketball there, and has lived in Southern California at various points in his career.
So would you say that the parting was mutual? Like, was the university also ready to move on, or were they sort of caught unawares?
That's a really good question. On just before Easter, athletic director Hunter Yurecek posted a tweet, and it's a video of him, and he hops on a bus, and that bus is being driven by Musselman, like the Muss bus, you know? And he says, he like jokes, "Wait, you're still here?" Because there had been rumors that Musselman was interested in other jobs that had suddenly opened up, like in Louisville and Michigan, SMU. Musselman's buyout was only $1 million, and some people thought that he might be getting a new contract. So the Yurecek tweet, everybody, like me, my friends, like most people I know, thought, oh, this means Musselman's back. Like maybe he got a new contract. That was the consensus, but some, you know, eagle-eyed fans put together pretty quickly that the video was actually like 3 years old and it was just slightly doctored. And then it became apparent, you know, that Musselman, who's super social media savvy, he's always on Twitter or X. He didn't like the tweet or retweet it and just went silent. So it was a little weird for a few days. Nobody really knew what was happening. And then Yurecek went on a podcast. So after Easter weekend on that Monday, I'm not sure when he actually went on the podcast, but this podcast clip aired of him saying that, you know, Musselman wasn't aware that that video was coming out and that he was still the coach here. Yeah, after that, you know, people began to wonder what was going on. By Friday, Musselman had announced that he was that he had taken the job at USC.
It's just strange to me that like this, we're in this age where in sports people communicate via social media, and there are like sort of social media tea leave readers, mm-hmm, looking at when players unfollow the team or like what they're like. You know, it's just strange. But
delete their whole Instagram account, yeah, or like everything associated with that team. Yeah, those things happen. It happens a lot now. Yeah.
Well, so can you tell us about how the Calipari thing happened?
Yeah. So the coaching search after Musselman left, it started out, there were reports from anonymous sources that Yurecek was in talks with a few different coaches throughout over the course of last week. It started out with Chris Beard, who is at Ole Miss. He at one time coached at UALR for 1 year, had like kind of a magical season there, took him to the NCAA tournament, upset number 5 seeded Purdue. Then he went on to Texas Tech and had really good success there. They went to the national championship game and lost. but he took a job at Texas and didn't complete his second season because he got fired on domestic assault charges. That he was first rumored to be the person we were trying to land. And after that, there was Will Wade, former LSU coach, currently at McNeese State. There was Jerome Tang of Kansas State. Even Arkansas Democrat Gazette reported on Saturday that Darrell Walker at UA Little Rock was going to be interviewing on Sunday. And then on Sunday, people started tweeting about Calipari being a possibility. And Wes Moore at Fox 16 Sports here in Little Rock was the first to report that a contract might be in the works. By 10:30 p.m., it was on the front page of ESPN the night before the national championship game between Purdue and Connecticut. Arkansas kind of became a big story.
Should it be surprising that a coach of that caliber came to Arkansas?
I don't think anybody expected him to. This is like one of the splashiest hires we've ever had, if not the splashiest, because he's won a national championship. I mean, he's been to six Final Fours in his career. And Kentucky, if he were to get fired by Kentucky, they would have owed him more than $30 million. So I don't think a lot of people saw this happening. He was not one of the names that was really out there. So, yeah, I think it was surprising. Despite all that success at Kentucky the past few years, they haven't been faring so well in the tournament. They haven't made it past the second weekend since 2019. And in the past 3 years, they've suffered two first-round losses. This year, they were upset in the first round by 14-seeded Oakland. So the fan base wasn't happy about that. But, you know, it was reported shortly after that loss that he would be returning to Kentucky most likely. So
in 2019, he was given what was described as a lifetime contract.
Right.
For that was like what? Like
currently
it was $8 million a year.
Yeah.
Right. And even though it was like a 10-year contract, but it's described as lifetime, that included an ambassadorship with the university after he retired.
Yeah. So that's another thing. Like, are we really going to be able to land the guy who's making the second highest salary in college basketball? Right. I didn't think so.
Yeah, let's talk about the salaries. On paper, it looks as though he's taking a pay cut, but he has the ability to make that up with incentives. So do you want to talk about the contract structure? You can do that.
So he'll be making $7 million with a yearly retention bonus of $500,000 and a signing bonus of $1 million. Eric Musselman, he had a $1 million buyout. And there's also incentives for NCAA tournament appearances and that go up depending on how far they get.
One of the other things that attracted him apparently was the NIL deal.
Yeah, so part of the reason this whole thing started is John Tyson, chairman of Tyson Foods. Juracek said in a press conference that he kind of acted as the conduit of making this meeting happen between the athletic director and Calipari. And Juracek said that the Tyson family and Warren Stevens and the Stevens family here in Little Rock worked together to put together a package to lure Calipari to Arkansas. Bo Wilcox wrote for Arkansas Times that, you know, that this is a statement that Arkansas and particularly the Tysons are not going to be an NIL doormat. I'm not sure how much, like, we're guaranteed to have or how much has been promised to be in our NIL collective, which is called the Arkansas Edge Collective, but it will probably compete with the highest that some of the top schools are making. Otherwise, Calipari wouldn't have done this. He's known for attracting NBA ready talent and the one and done players that play 1 year in college and then get drafted in the NBA. He's had more than 40 players get drafted into the NBA throughout the course of his career. That's a lot. So he wouldn't be coming here if our NIL was struggling.
Yeah, that's quite a resume. I think it might be worth it for people who don't follow sports if we kind of talk about how college sports got to the point where NIL was a thing. So for one, for people who don't know, NIL stands for name, image, likeness, and it's the ability of players to sort of profit off of their name, image, likeness, and likeness, even as college players, where previously that was prohibited. And the short history of that is that there was a lawsuit between a former player named Ed O'Bannon and the NCAA, who realized that his image was still being used long after he stopped playing college ball, and he went and he looked at the contract that he signed as a high schooler going into college, and the language said that it gave them the right to use the image and likeness, quote, forever in perpetuity throughout the universe, end quote. And so there was a lawsuit filed on antitrust grounds. They won, the NCAA lost, and then they created these rules that I think were finalized in like 2021,
right,
about the NIL stuff, which allowed states to pass laws governing how exactly this would be implemented. So the NCAA itself, I don't think, makes the rules over NIL, but state legislatures do.
From what I understand, it's not very well regulated right now.
Yeah. That in conjunction with, I guess, some changes to the transfer portal have created like a more equal landscape in college athletics, especially with the big sports where players are more free to transfer from one school to another, right? Like,
yeah, that's like what makes this super interesting, is that Calipari is coming into Arkansas and there's essentially no team as far as the scholarship players go. 13 scholarship players, they're all gone. Several transferred out. All of them transferred out before Calipari was even announced. Some transferred before Musselman left, some after. One player, Trevin Brazil, announced after the hiring that he would be hiring an agent and looking toward the NBA draft. Our two incoming freshmen that Musselman had signed both opened up their recruitment. They could decide to come back. We just don't know where that's going to go yet. Or any of the transfer players could also potentially come back. And we don't know which of Kentucky's players that were on the roster or that were signed to come play for Calipari, whether or not they will be coming over with him. So that's what people are going to be watching in the next few days, weeks, and months. But he has to put together an entire roster.
How's the fan base reacted to the news of the hiring?
They seem really excited, considering that, you know, he's been such a rival for so many years. A lot of people didn't like him. But, I mean, I think it was estimated that 7,000 people showed up to the press conference at Bud Walton Arena last night. We had a reporter there, Brian Sorensen. It seemed like he really won people over with his charm and energy. He did say that, and he said this in a video before he announced on Wednesday that he'd be coming here, you know, that that he and his wife loved their time in Kentucky, and they gave it all they had, and they were sad to leave, but with no regrets. He described himself as a gatherer, someone who brings fans and staff and players together. Said he's a player's coach and puts them first, and that he's here to compete for championships. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, well, thanks, Rhett.
Thank you.
Yeah. Finally today, last year, the passage of Act 851 prohibited the right of local cities and counties to regulate the practice of Bitcoin mining. The measure has come under scrutiny as citizens have realized that there is little they can do in the wake of several problems that come along with the practice. Dave and Benji are back to talk about the recent efforts to roll back elements of Act 851.
As we said, the session is a fiscal session, but there is a path for lawmakers to introduce non-budget bills. And there is one topic in particular where there's a number of legislators that are introducing resolutions to try to get some bills out there. And that is around cryptocurrency mining. So tell us what's going on there. Why are people talking about this and what's happening?
Yeah. So a law was passed last year that basically kind of negated the ability of local towns and counties to do the normal kinds of regulation they might do on one particular type of business, which is Bitcoin mines. So they're called mines because I think the tech industry likes these kind of weird metaphors that evoke the physical world, like manufacturing or agriculture or whatever. But in fact, they're just a big network of very powerful computers. And the reason that they exist is because, without getting too far into the weeds, the process that Bitcoin uses in order to confirm transactions and also to create new Bitcoin currency involves solving these weird cryptographic puzzles. All you really have to know is that they're incredibly complex. You can think of it as just a math problem.
Right.
And in order to solve it with any type of speed, because they're so difficult, you need these big networks of super powerful computers, and whoever solves the puzzle first gets rewarded buy, there's basically new Bitcoin is created, and so they end up getting a big payout in Bitcoin for solving the puzzle.
You know, I got some complaints around the office earlier today when you wrote about this, and you prefaced a paragraph with saying, I'm going to oversimplify this, and then you proceeded to say what you just said, and everybody was like, what the hell?
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. Okay, okay, let me try this. They have to solve a really hard math problem, and they get money for solving a really hard math problem. And so there's this...
The crux of the matter is, I mean, it's people make tons of money off of just sort of letting these computers run and do their thing, right?
Like, yes, this is... right. It's an arms race. Like, all you really have to know is that you have these companies that are trying to, they're like just in the world's dumbest game of math Olympics or whatever, and they're trying to solve the really hard problem first, and it's only possible to do that with incredibly powerful computers. And the problem is that these computers take up a ton of energy. They also have to use a ton of water because you have to keep the computers cool, and the fans that keep the computers cool make a terrible noise, and it sucks for everyone nearby because you have to listen potentially even 24/7 to this awful noise. So that's like a huge bummer for local residents. It like reduces their quality of living. It has apparently spooked like the livestock. Right. There's fears about impacts on birds and wildlife, which is going to mess up hunting and other, you know, just sort of natural beauty, outdoorsy stuff. And, you know, there's also the just kind of broader environmental issues of using that much power. So basically, it's not great for local residents to be near one of these facilities.
Are there any benefits to, like, I mean, they're not creating really jobs, right?
I think basically the answer is no. I mean, I think, you know, if you have a football field sized tract of land that you can sell to one of these operations, I guess those landowners would benefit. But there's really not much other benefit. Part of the way I think this was sold to people was, you know, there was a push to kind of reshore. In other words, instead of having these data call centers is what I'm trying to describe, instead of having them be in another country, to have them here. And sometimes those got placed in rural communities, and like they weren't amazing or anything, but they provided, you know, some jobs for the local community. And I think there was kind of a sense that maybe this would be like that, but instead it's just a bunch of computers. And maybe you have, I mean, according to the New York Times article, there's some heavy duty security outside of some of these facilities, but
right.
I doubt they're recruiting those folks from, the local community. So there's really no benefit at all. They're just not contributing to anything in terms of growing the economy or sort of being part of the broader community. They're just stuffing a bunch of computers. And from the perspective of farmers, right. They're, you know, taking water and energy that could be used for like irrigation system. And instead they're like providing high powered fans to cool off computers, which is like kind of a hard sell for local farmers. So people like really generally, I think pretty consistently when one of these things goes up, people around it don't like it. But what this bill did, and I think it's worth saying, this bill was, there wasn't a lot of talk about it. I think very few legislators really understood it.
And this is the 2023 bill, right?
Exactly. It was written by a somewhat shady lobbyist group that is backing these operations. I don't think anyone really knew what was going on. 8 days after it was filed, it passed. And then you now have this situation where residents that are furious really have no recourse because, you know, the local government can't do anything about it. So this is stirred up, and I'm actually about to post a video from a citizens group near DeWitt or in Arkansas County, I should say, that's very compelling, that kind of has a range of local residents who have a lot of complaints and a lot of frustrations, and also just a message of wanting local control and wanting to have some say so in this process, which of course, you know, once upon a time we might have associated that with conservatives, and so that might be an appealing message to Republican legislators. But in any event, you know, there's been a push to, even though normally in a fiscal session, as you said, you don't deal with stuff like this, there's enough of an uproar that there's been a number of bills filed. They're actually resolutions, but that doesn't matter. There's an attempt to have bills that address this. One of them is from Senator Joshua Bryant out of Rogers, who was one of the co-sponsors of the original bill. I think what I would say about it is that it does make some changes, but it doesn't address this issue of giving back local control. And I think this is my, I don't know if it's for a fact, but my intuition is that the lobbyist groups or the entities behind the Bitcoin operators were probably involved in that bill as a kind of, I think there's some lawmakers who maybe still want to, support the general idea that they did before, but don't want to get yelled at. So they're trying to kind of come up with a lipstick on a pig kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Senator Missy Irvin, which is maybe a little bit of a different situation, is trying to kind of propose some setup for like state level regulations and state level noise ordinance and that kind of thing that I think would at least address some concerns. And then Brian King, who's been the most outspoken about this issue and, is a very libertarian frenemy of the Arkansas Times,
right.
Like hates Medicaid expansion, but loves the FOI, that kind of a character.
Right.
He has six potential bills, one of which is stalled for now, although I think there's a chance it'll come back. And he is taking a much more aggressive approach that would really undo a lot of what that act did, give back local control, and also impose some regulations and potential fees for overuse of energy to kind of deal with, because regardless of what happens, some of these are just there. And so even if more regulation is possible, you want to make sure, that you have the capacity for tough enough regulation to actually satisfy local concerns. So
yeah.
In any event, I think those are the more, from the perspective of, as I was saying, like this group from DeWitt that's so frustrated, and the other, I think there's at least maybe nine of these around the state, and several of them have already had kind of some local protest or attempted legal action and that kind of thing. So in terms of the people that really hate what the Bitcoin mining law did last year and aren't happy about the impacts of these facilities, I think they're going to be more on the side of Brian King's bills. So
yeah.
We'll see what happens. It's hard to do this during a fiscal session. For one thing, you need 2/3 approval from both the House and the Senate just to even consider them. Now, that seems like that won't be an issue in the Senate, which already has approved most of them, but maybe a little more of a sticking point in the House. So we'll see what happens. But I think that you're going to see a combination of the Bryant bill, which, as I said, is a little more of a lipstick on a pig thing. I think that's probably going to have some legs, and it's going to kind of be the forum for potentially trying to come up with some sort of compromise that at least allows legislators to do something. I think there's going to be much more controversy around the King bills, which if you hate what's going on, that's the bill for you, but there's still some lobbying muscle to get in the way. So we'll have to see what happens.
Okay. Well, let's leave it there.
All right. Thank you, Benji.
And that's the show for this week. Thanks for listening to the Arkansas Times Week in Review. You can contact us with comments about the show by emailing us at podcast@arctimes.com. That's podcasts@arctimes.com. Enjoy your weekend. We'll see you next week.